What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Veterinarians cover all animal species, domesticated and wild. They deal with the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of disease, disorders, and injury in animals. Veterinary science also addresses human health and the monitoring and control of diseases that may be transmitted to humans from animals. Joining me here at the roundtable, I welcome all of the students from Rickards High School. I'm always glad to have you all. Christian Hill. Christian is a junior at Rickards in the Health Academy program, and he is interested in veterinary medicine.
Hi, guys. Nice to be here.
Holly Berger. I'm always nice to have her. She is a sophomore. She's interested in gerontology and also pediatrician.
Hey, hope everybody's having a good day.
Alexandria Davis Jenkins. She's in 10th grade, interested in veterinary medicine.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
And Leonard Lindsay, junior in neurology.
Nice to be here.
Okay, glad to have you. The Rap with a Pro series provides high-interest high school students the opportunity to talk directly with a health professional. This hour, 411 Teen features veterinarian Dr. Carlos Varela. Buck Lake Animal Hospital. Dr. Varela is a graduate of Tuskegee University School of Veterinary Medicine. Welcome to 411 Teen.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming. And I have to say, he's my vet. He takes great care of my dogs. Glad to have you. I really appreciate you coming. We have all kinds of questions. They have all kinds of questions. I want to start with just what does the training in veterinary medicine involve?
Sure. You know, it's similar to medicine, and a difference being we learn about all different species. So we're learning more than one species, as opposed to in human medicine, we're learning about just the human body itself. Mm-hmm. But if we want to start with, let's say, you know, we're talking here to high school students, you know, we can start our training now. If we're interested in the field, we can certainly try to contact your veterinarian and try to talk to them and tell them, listen, I'm interested in this field. Is there any way that I could perhaps come in and volunteer or shadow you for a few days and try to see if that's something that you're really interested in? And a lot of times, you know, it really helps you focus on what you want to do. And then from there, once you go into college, you can start with a pre-vet program. Most universities will have them. You can do that at FSU or FAMU. Just do a biology or a basic science program. I have a bachelor's in science in animal, dairy, and poultry science. I did my bachelor's at LSU. And then from there, I applied to veterinary school in Tuskegee. So that was 4 years of veterinary medicine training after my bachelor's.
How difficult is it to get into med school, veterinary medicine?
It's pretty competitive. It is difficult. We're looking at less than 30 veterinary schools here in the mm-hmm. country. So if we take into consideration, you know, if the average class size was about 100 and there's 30 schools, for example, you're looking about, you know, 3,000 people getting into veterinary school every year. On average, mm-hmm. it can be a little bit more, sure. a little bit less. So it's very important to have, you know, obviously very good grades when you have a bachelor's and a lot of experience. It does help as well.
Okay. Questions? Don't let me take them.
How long do you have to go to school?
Veterinary school, for example? Yeah. It was 4 years.
Do you have to do any sort of residency?
You can do – so once you graduate from veterinary school – you can do an internship. So an internship, you would get advanced training in different fields. You can do what's called a rotating internship. So you can go to a specialty hospital, for example, and you can learn from different specialists. We have the same amount of specialists in veterinary medicine just as in human medicine. So you have neurologists, dermatologists, cardiologists, surgery, internal medicine. I mean, you name it, and it pretty much is up to par with human medicine. So you can do an internship. Then once you're done with an internship, then you can apply for a residency. In a residency, you can pick and choose, well, I'm a veterinarian, but I want to specialize in cardiology or neurology, for example.
How long would the internship take?
It depends. Internships can be anywhere between 1 to 2 years, and the residencies after that, it can range, 3 to 5 years, depending on the specialty.
Mm-hmm. So what inspired you to become a veterinarian? Was that like an inspiration, a dream or something? Or
Very good question. So when I was growing up, when I was in high school, my dad asked me what I wanted to be, when I went to college, what I wanted to do. And I actually wanted to be an engineer. And I think part of that was my dad worked in the construction business. So I think I kind of saw just like any other kid would see their dad and they want to do what they do. And he said, well, if that's what you want to do, why don't you, go work, at a construction site or with an engineer and see if you really like that. And I spent one summer with one of his friends who was a contractor, and I liked it, but it wasn't something that I felt like it was a calling for me. And then I just started thinking, as we were growing up, we always had animals in the house. Mostly, we had just farm animals, chickens and stuff of that sort. And, I felt like that's what I wanted to do. And at that point, I was probably like 14 or 15. We had a dog and we were taking him to the veterinarian, and I approached him and said, this is something that I might be interested in. Is there any way that I can come in and perhaps just shadow you for a few days? And the shadowing for a few days turned into weeks and months, and then next thing you know, I'm working there. And I worked there through high school, my bachelor's, and all through veterinary school.
What was your biggest obstacle in becoming a veterinarian?
Getting into school was difficult just because it's very, very competitive. I applied to multiple schools. I think it was probably about 5 or 6 different veterinary schools. I got accepted into Tuskegee University. I didn't get accepted off the bat. I was on a wait list. So that means that, let's say they accept 100 students and they take another 20, and you're like in what you can call like a backup list. If for any reason any of those students decide they don't want to go to that school, because there will be some students that will get accepted to multiple schools, well, then they start going down that list and saying, well, next one up, next one up. So it was kind of, it was scary because I was on that list. So I was excited that I was on the list, but then again, not knowing what was going to happen. So I think that was kind of a challenge there. Just actually, I think the hardest thing is actually getting into the school, into school itself.
So would there be a chance, like you were talking about internships at the veterinary hospitals and all that, would there be a chance if I could do that at the Butt Lake Hospital?
Sure. I mean, you just come in and, you can come and we can certainly talk after the show. And I can give you my number and the number of the hospital, and we can certainly accommodate for you to come in and spend some time with us.
Okay.
Well, certainly.
Okay. I have a question. In your training, do you make a distinction, even I know it's with all animals, but do you make a distinction between zoo animals and small cats and dogs and farm animals? Do you make that distinction, or does that matter?
So, I mean, when you're in school, we're learning all the different species. Obviously, you can take a special interest in, for example, what you call a small animal practitioner. So I just, see cats, dogs, and I like exotic animal medicine. So, I'll see the pocket pets like hamsters, guinea pigs, snakes, rabbits, and so forth. But that's what I decided that I wanted to focus on, as opposed to dealing with large animal, horses or cows and so forth. And you can, while you're in school, you got to learn all of them, but you can slowly kind of, there's certain classes that will help you get to, kind of set those goals of where you want to be.
I've seen that there's this thing called an all veterinarian that they work on small and large animals.
Mm-hmm.
How long would it take to be one of those because I've heard that it's easier to go on like one track working with just like small animals or large animals or except and not all of them.
Yeah. So you mean when you're in school or once you're out of school?
While in school.
Yeah. So every school is going to be different, and every school is going to have different programs. While I was at Tuskegee, I don't know how it is now, but while I was there, we were learning. You're learning all the species, which, you know, when you take your board examination, when you graduate from veterinary school, you got to take a test. And after you take that test, then you can take your state board. So there's different tests so you can be licensed in every state that you practice in. So knowing all the species, at least at that point, was beneficial. Because it did help me, you know, for that test and specifically. But once you're out of school, there are veterinarians that will do both. I mean, they'll see horses and they'll see farm animals. Sometimes they'll bring them to their office and they'll see, you know, cats and dogs at the same time. That's just their preference. So,
what about the cost of medical school?
That's a good question, and it's a topic that's been talked about a lot lately in the field. It's going to vary between schools, but you know, if you can go to, for example, if you live here in Florida and you went to UF, which would be the veterinary school here in the state, perhaps, you know, the in-state tuition would be a little bit less than out of state, but I can't tell you the exact number, but I would say, you know, there's veterinarians graduating from vet school with $200,000 to $250,000 in, you know, in student loans from vet school itself. So
everybody had a look on their face like, oh, but you know, you graduate and you're going to have some cost involved.
Yeah. And I mean, that's an extreme. I mean, there are veterinarians that, you know, won't have as much of student loan debt, but it's still something that's out there. I mean, you are going to have some type of student loan debt unless you're very fortunate that you have parents that, you know, can certainly cover those costs.
Hold your thoughts. You're tuned in to 411 Teen Weekly Program. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and joining me is Dr. Carlos Varela, Buck Lake Animal Hospital, and I have Rickards High School students from the Millicent Holyfield Academy of Health Sciences. This program is part of the Wrap with a Pro series, providing students interested in various health fields the opportunity to talk directly with a health professional. We are talking about veterinary medicine today. Do any of you want to start out with a question?
Sure. In reference to after college and student loans, like, did you ever pay off your loans?
I'm actually still paying on my student loans. It's kind of like a mortgage on a house, I guess you can compare it to. It's something that, you know, I have a – you can pay it off over time. It's not something that you're going to necessarily have to pay all this money immediately after you graduate. You know, my loans, they're spread out over 30 years. So I still have about 20 years to pay mine off. Obviously, it's one of those things that, like any other debt, you'd want to try to pay off sooner if you can. But, I mean, it's something that you can certainly break it up over a period of time to pay them off.
How much do veterinarians usually make?
Good question, and that's all going to depend, you know, on what field they go into. Is it going to be private practice? Are they going to be working for the government? Are we going to be doing, you know, lab animal medicine, large animals, small animals? So there's a wide range. I think you can, you know, a guesstimate starting out of school, you may be looking at anywhere between, you know, depending where you're at in the country, 50 to $70,000 or $80,000, depending on when you practice in the country. You know, if you go like out west somewhere in California where the cost of living is going to be a little bit higher, you might be getting paid a little bit more, but that's because your cost of living is more.
Would you talk about the allied professions? I mean, like, for example, a vet tech. What does that mean?
Sure. So a veterinary technician is almost the equivalent of your human nurse. So okay. They're there to, you know, take care of that patient. They're there. I mean, they're like my right hand in the profession. I mean, they're there to assist me, take care of my patients, to help with physical exams, administer medications, and so forth. So it's pretty much the equivalent of a nurse.
Okay.
What's your favorite part, personally, of your occupation?
Just helping animals in itself. I think it's a very neat profession. You know, they can't tell you what's going on with them. And I think it's neat that we are able to, you know, fix them, or we want to say cure them or help them with their problems without them really telling us. So it's almost like playing detective. You got to try to figure out what's going on with the animal or the pet without them really being able to communicate in words. Because sometimes, you know, if they're crying or they hurt somewhere, you can pinpoint certain things. But it's mostly, you know, you're taking the history from the owner or pet parent. You know, they're telling you what they think's going on with their pet. And then from there, it's like putting clues together and try to figure out what's going on. I think it's just a neat challenge. So that's kind of what I like about it.
So what would you think the best field of veterinary medicine would be best on, just basically anything? It doesn't matter, person or just, you know, because you said there's like large animals.
Sure, and that is one of those things that it's all going to depend on the person itself. So I personally, I like, you know, cats and dogs, and I love dealing with exotic animals, you know, and small pets. So that's what I like. So that's kind of what I like to concentrate in. But it's all going to be on what you feel your calling is. I mean, some veterinarians, you know, they grew up with horses, so that when they go into veterinary school, they know that that's what they're going to work on. That's what they want to do. Some of them, you know, family may own cattle or dairy farms, and that's what they want to work with. So it all depends on the person itself and kind of what their interests are.
What's the most exotic animal you've
seen? Well, I've been very fortunate in my, I guess, short career. When I graduated from veterinary school, I went out and I practiced in Las Vegas for 7.5 years. So I was very fortunate to work at a practice under Dr. Randy Ceballos, he was a veterinarian for a lot of the illusionists and magicians out there in the city. So I was able to help him out with lions, tigers, panthers, and so forth. So I've worked with all those animals with him, assisting him. And I've also worked with, you know, stingrays and all those kinds of those sorts. So those are, you know, kind of, you know, the most exotic animals that I've been able to. And it's been very neat. So I was very fortunate to do that early in my career.
Well, back to dogs and cats. What are some of the common disorders that you see in dogs and cats?
Sure. So a lot of the things that, you know, the most common things that a lot of times we'll see our pets for example, here in Florida, we're going to see a lot of dogs that are itchy. You know, sometimes it's just our climate, you know, the weather here in Florida. Sometimes it could be fleas. So, you know, we could be dealing with allergies or flea, you know, intestinal parasites are some of the most common things that we see here. Ear infections. Sometimes they'll have, you know, problems with their stomach, so vomiting and diarrhea. Those are the most common things. But a lot of times, you know, some days it'll be pretty routine, so we'll just see them for preventative medicine, so, you know, their vaccinations and so forth. So,
okay. Questions?
How would one go about starting your own veterinary practice?
Good question. So, that's a very good question, actually. So how would you go about doing something like that? Well, one of the things that you got to do is you'd have to establish a business plan. So you'd have to talk to, obviously, a bank, or hopefully you have a mentor that can guide you on what to do. Because it's not just being a veterinarian at that point, you're looking at being a business owner. So there's a lot of other responsibilities that entails. So you're not only practicing medicine, but then you're also taking care of all the people, all your employees, so your veterinary technicians, your office manager, your receptionist, the people that work in the kennel and take care of the dogs. Then you also got to pay all the bills, order everything. But I think it's something that if that's what you want to do, anybody that sets their mind to do something, they can do it. And it's, you know, banks generally will lend money to veterinarians just because the default rate on a loan like that is very, very, very low. So I, for example, just started this practice, or I bought a practice that was existing, and it's been there for over 25 years. And, you know, I approached a bank, and they lent me the money. So it's kind of like, you know, buying a house instead of you just – I just bought an animal hospital.
I've heard that math and science are the two major subjects of on the road to becoming a veterinarian. Is that true?
So you do focus mostly on the science part. Mm-hmm. Math, every school is going to have different requirements. So depending on where you think you want to go to school or the schools, you got to narrow it down. I mean, there's a lot of schools, and you're only going to be able to apply to certain schools. Every time you apply to a school, you have to, you know, pay money to apply to a vet school. So, you know, I picked about five or six other schools, and I looked at all the requisites for all those schools and said, okay, so this school, most of the schools that I applied to, it was mostly the sciences, not as much as the maths. I think the highest math I had to take in while I was in undergrad was maybe pre-calculus and trigonometry. And with that, I was able to get – well, I got – yeah. I think those were the higher math ones. I did have to take some physics, but it was mostly science classes, and it always helps. A lot of schools do require some type of animal science classes, whether it's in animal science or dairy science or poultry science. So any of those will certainly help. But, yeah, it's, you know, a lot of the math and the sciences are involved in there.
How difficult was it to learn the different anatomy of all the different animals?
It's hard. So you're still remember our first year in vet school. That's when we learned anatomy, and that kind of piles on to everything else. So it was challenging because you're looking at, you know, a lot of things are called the same, but they might look a little different depending on the animal. So it was challenging, and there was a lot of studying and late nights involved, but it's like anything else. I mean, if you put your mind to it, you should be able to do it.
What's the most rewarding part of your job?
I think it goes back to just being able to, you know, help the animals. And not only that, I mean, animals, pets in general, you know, they're part of our family nowadays. So being able to, you know, take care of somebody's family member or four-legged family member, you want to call it, I think it's very rewarding just making sure that, you know, if we have a pet that's sick and we can, you know, make him or her better, it's always rewarding making sure that, you know, they feel better.
Carlos, how do you feel about, I guess I would call it purely cosmetic procedures? I mean, you know, the docking of the tails, the clipping of the ears, you know, declawing. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, those are all obviously in a profession like this, and depending who you talk to, they're very touchy subjects, I guess. You know, in at least in the European countries, a lot of places, and even here in the U.S., there's a lot of counties and cities that have banned all of these procedures. I think there are times for some of the procedures that we got to take into consideration what's going on in the household. For example, declawing, you know, yes, it's a very painful procedure for our kitty cats, but there are certain instances that we may have to do it because we may have somebody that's a little older and with diabetes, and their kitty cats are not really scratching them. But when they jump off of, for example, a diabetic patient, they may leave some marks, and mm-hmm. people with diabetes can't heal as well. So we're looking at somebody getting rid of their pet or family member if we don't, you know, mm-hmm. perform a declaw. So and I guess it depends on the situation, and depending on what's, you know, what's going on, then we can approach those things accordingly.
Why for a regular checkup for my dog, I always look at the little, you know, receipt that you always have to pay for care. I see like $150 and all that. Why is it so expensive like that?
So it all depends on everything that you're looking at. So it all depends what they did that day. So when you bring your pet in for, you know, let's say a yearly checkup with vaccine, so you're going to have an examination, so that's the time that your veterinarian takes to examine your pet. So we're starting at the tip of the nose to the tip of the tail. We're listening to the heart. We're looking at their ears, their eyes, looking at the skin. We're feeling all over, make sure that there's no growths. So that's our time, and obviously asking you how your pet's doing. Then in that, there may be what we call an intestinal parasite check. So we're looking for intestinal parasites that your pet may have. They may also be doing a heartworm check, so checking for, you know, heartworms, and, of course, the vaccination. So if we look at, you know, the cost of veterinary medicine versus human medicine, we a lot of times we don't see the, you know, we don't see a big bill, if we want to call it, from the human side, because a lot of people have insurance,
right,
and there's deductibles. Now, somebody that didn't have insurance, if they had to come out of pocket for all those costs, it'd be much, much higher than that.
I've heard that you can go into the veterinary teaching for some things if you get high enough up.
Academia, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like one of the veterinarians I shadowed, he taught some classes even though he was also working with like farm animals. Like how high do you have to be in order to do that?
So it's one of those things that it's just a preference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my wife, for example, she likes academia. She is – my wife's a veterinarian as well here in town. She loves academia. And if she had the opportunity of – you know, she has applied for different positions to try to teach. Just nothing has come through for her at this point. But it's one of those things that if that's what you want to do, you don't have to be – have, you know – specific credentials for you to be able to teach. Is just, you know, the availability of a position, and depending on where you're at, obviously somebody that has some type of specialty and they decided to go teach at a university, well, that person might get the job over somebody that doesn't have a specialty, but it all depends on what they're looking for. If they just want a general practitioner or somebody that just has the degree itself, you should be okay. So it all depends on what specific criteria they're looking for the job itself. So me as a general practitioner, for example, if I wanted to go teach somewhere, if there was a position available, they'd just go through the interview process just like any other job. And if they felt that I met that criteria and that I was, I had what they needed, then, you know, I would get the job. So it all depends on if that's what you wanted to do and just applying for a job and what they're looking for. But I think anybody can go into academia if they wanted to.
In selecting a pet, would you comment on whether to go the breeder route or the pet shop route?
You know, and it's one of those things that, obviously it's one of those subjects that we're looking at. I mean, obviously there's overpopulation of pets in the country itself, and it's everywhere. It's not just here in this country. So obviously we always like to look at, you know, our shelters. I personally, you know, we personally would go to a shelter to adopt any of our pets. Our pets that we have now, they're all rescues. But there are certain things, you know, we are in this country, people use their dogs for work. So there are certain specific breeds that somebody might not be able to find at a shelter, or they're looking for a specific type of dog. For example, if they're going to go hunting and they might need some type of hunting dog, then they might want to approach a reputable breeder. I mean, there's reputable breeders out there, mm-hmm. As opposed to what we call the puppy mills. So mm-hmm. it all depends on what we're looking for.
Okay.
What's the worst case you've ever seen?
I've seen... That's a good one. You know, I've seen a lot of cases where, you know, just neglect in general. So, you know, people that they're not taking care of their pets as they should. I mean, they are a responsibility. You know, I wouldn't say necessarily a luxury, but sometimes they are. I mean, if we were taking in, you know, a leaving creature and we're taking responsibility to take care of it, and sometimes, you know, there's neglect, and sometimes, you know, there's people that, you know, they just can't, they believe that they can take it on, but they can't. But I've seen a lot of dogs and cats and even, you know, rabbits with maggots. So, meaning, you know, these animals have some type of wound or injury and they've just been in the backyard, and you don't get maggots, you know, overnight. It's something that's just been there. And I've seen that. I've seen, obviously, dog fights, you know, broken bones. I mean, there's a lot of things. It's just kind of hard to pick one, you know. But those things, you know, they kind of touch you a little bit closer to home when you're trying to take care of them, but you know you have somebody that comes in and they're, you know, probably not taking care of their pet how you would think they should.
How do you handle that? And if you have a pet, and you probably can think about it because we're going to take a break, but if you have a patient and he comes in and it's obviously been abused or neglected, what do you do? And just hold your thoughts for my listening audience. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and I'm talking with Dr. Carlos Varela, and I have students from the Millicent Holifield Academy of Health Sciences, and we are giving them the opportunity to talk directly with a health professional. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I had to interrupt you, Carlos. So would you address that? We're talking about if you have a pet or an animal that is being examined by the veterinarian and he or she recognizes that this pet has been severely abused or neglected. What do you do? How do you handle that?
Sure. And it's one of those things that you have to very carefully, you know, address the situation, but obviously we're there. I mean, we're here to protect these animals and take care of them. So, I mean, we just, you know, it's something that you just contact the authorities, whether it be, you know, in this case, animal control or the police. I mean, there are laws to protect, you know, that protect, you know, animals, just like there's laws to protect, you know, people from physical abuse.
Exactly.
I mean, there's laws out there that protect our pets as well.
Okay. Animals seem to have similar conditions that humans have. For example, I mean, they can be diabetic, right?
Yes, most certainly.
Can you talk about that? I find that interesting.
Sure. And I mean, there's a lot of, even though they're completely different species, there are a lot of conditions that we see out there. Diabetes, for example, one of them, you know, in animals. And, you know, you can have diabetes. A lot of times we'll see it from obesity. So just like, if we're obese and we don't take care of ourselves, not everybody, but some people will develop diabetes, so it makes them prone to that. So the same thing with our pets. And our pets, diabetes is something that's – it's insulin-dependent, so we do use insulin. In some cases, we will use the same insulin that, you know, we would use if we had diabetes. And some of our medications are going to be, you know, similar to the ones that, you know, we have clients all the time that – they look at the bottle of medication that we've prescribed for their pets and like, oh, that's what my doctor prescribed for me. But we also got to be very, very careful and not assume that all medications that are safe for us are safe for our pets. You know, for example, Tylenol, ibuprofen, a lot of those pain medications that we take, they're, you know, they're very, very dangerous and toxic to our pets.
I see. Okay. Any other questions?
So more on the toxic thing. So I just recently, my dog has eaten chocolate, and, you know, I had a panic attack because I heard and I read that that kills my dog, but apparently when I read on the internet, it says it depends on what, how much he eats and what type it is and all that. Can you get more into that?
Certainly. So it's one of those things, you know, any amount can certainly be toxic, and it's all going to depend on the size of the pet and obviously what else could be going on with the pet. It's just like I may, you know, for some people, let's say a small amount of shellfish might be mm-hmm. extremely toxic to them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I can eat, you know, buckets of shrimp and be okay. So just because we ate, you know, your pet ate, you know, whatever amount of chocolate it was and he was okay, it doesn't mean that, you know, if you have another pet and he or her eats the same amount of chocolate that they're going to be okay. But yes, I mean, Baker's chocolate, for example, is a type of chocolate that is going to be much more toxic as opposed to milk chocolate. But anytime that you have a pet that ingests chocolate, you should at least call your veterinarian to try to see what you need to do from there.
And talking about eating, let's look at their diet. Can you talk about the diet for a dog, per se? I mean, is it better for them? How do you feel about scraps? You know, a lot of people will give them scraps. Is it better for them to have scraps? Are wet food or dry food, or what do you recommend?
Sure. I mean, preferably no scraps or table food, or, you know, sometimes they'll ask somebody if they've been feeding scraps and they will say, well, it's not scraps. You know, it's the same thing that we ate. You know, the dog had steak or chicken. You know, all these things, our pets are not used to eating all those things, and certainly they can cause, you know, stomach problems, and it can lead to very severe medical issues as well, especially if we're feeding, you know, chicken bones or chicken wings. I mean, or, you know, chicken parts, you know, the bones can splinter and they can certainly perforate, you know, the intestines or cause an obstruction. So food-wise, you know, there's pets, you know, obviously it's just like humans. I mean, when you're babies, you're concentrating on certain types of foods. And as you mature and you're growing older, your needs of your diet change. And it's the same thing for our pets. You know, younger dogs will need certain type of foods as opposed to a dog that's what we consider an adult or young dog or an older dog. I mean, their diets, and it's one of those things that, you know, when you bring your pets to your veterinarian, you know, they can certainly assess what life stage your dog may be in try to guide you or help you decide what type of food you might want to feed them. There's dry and in the canned. It all depends. I mean, it's certainly a preference. Mm-hmm. They can certainly both be beneficial to your pets.
I think because I have a friend who goes through what I would consider a number of changes to feed her dog. I mean, she makes organic food and she makes sure he has, I don't know, hamburger. And so I just wonder.
Yeah, I mean, I've encountered multiple clients that we have people that don't want to feed their dogs commercial dog foods mm-hmm. and they cook for their pets. Mm-hmm. And some of these, you know, cats and dogs are eating better than you and me.
That's right.
And I mean, and that's you know, some people have done their research and, you know, they've mm-hmm. looked at what they can or can't feed their dog, and that's certainly their preference. And I mean, that's okay. I mean, if that's what, you know, they decide that they want to do, ultimately, you know, it's their decision. Sometimes we'll discourage certain things that they might be feeding their pet, or we may be able to help them, you know, mm-hmm. decide, well, maybe you shouldn't feed them those things, or maybe you should feed them this instead.
As we look at the milieu that dogs exist in, what impact does smoking have on dogs?
You know, very good question. It's one of those things I've certainly encountered, I believe, just like anybody that's in a room with somebody that's smoking, there's secondhand smoke. So even though you're not smoking, but you're living in a household that somebody smokes, you can certainly have all the detrimental side effects from smoking. It can certainly affect our pets. We have pets that develop asthma or respiratory problems in households where there is smoking. So, you know, they can certainly have all the detrimental side effects just like we would if we were somewhere with somebody that was smoking.
Oh, that's like, I guess dogs can get Ebola. I mean, in looking at this, talk about, I mean, because, you know, they kill one dog. What was that, over in Spain? They killed the nurse's dog. And then here, I think one of the health professionals, her dog was in quarantine for 21 days. Would you address that?
Sure. I'm not an expert in the subject by any means, but Sure. I mean, I guess, the dog in Spain, I mean, that was the decision of the health department out there. The dog here, it was quarantined, and, I mean, it was determined by the CDC that the dog was fine. Sure. I mean, I guess it could be carriers of the disease itself. I don't think it's been proven that, like I said, I'm not an expert in the subject, so don't quote me on any of these things, but that it can be one of those things that, you know, we're going to be passing it back and forth. So I think, you know, what was done here, the pet was quarantined and it was deemed that it was safe. So they spared the that nurse's dog's life.
Yeah.
So I've been hearing, well, from this conversation so far, that dogs have a lot of, well, any animal in general has a lot of comparisons to us. So what about, you know, problem solving, just thinking in general? Because when my phone rang, I didn't know it was ringing. My dog just came up to me and started barking, and I looked and see my phone's ringing. So I don't know how he gets that.
Sure. And I mean, animals are smarter than what we a lot of times give them credit for. There's dogs out there. I mean, it's just their intuition. They'll learn certain behaviors. They'll watch you. They see that, you know, you may be seeing that your phone's ringing, and, you know, maybe you're expecting a call from your girlfriend or your mom, and you're running over there trying to, you know, get on the phone before it stops ringing, and your dog sees you that you're trying to get to that phone. So he might be, you know, he learns that behavior. So he might be seeing that you're not going for the phone, and he's just trying to let you know, hey, you know, something's going on here. And they do it for a lot of things. You know, there's been dogs that have woken up families from fires to let them know, hey, you know, it's safe. It's not safe. There's dogs out there now that help people, you know, let them know when they're about to have a seizure. They'll exactly. alert them so they can sit down and don't hurt themselves. There's, you know, animals out there that help with cancer, certainly. There's animals out there that, you know, just like anything else, detect cadavers. So, I mean, they're very, very, very smart, and they learn very, very quickly.
They really are. I know Biko, my dog, was running up and down the steps one day, just back and forth and back and forth. And I looked at Ed, and I was like, what is wrong with him? And so finally I thought, let me follow him and see. Well, my van had caught on fire. And I guess he could smell it. Well, we couldn't smell it. He knew something. And he was trying to tell us that the van was on, you know, it was on fire. I mean, it was full, you know, fire. So they can be helpful. They can be a pain, too, though. Other questions?
Do you think that dogs can pick up human characteristics? Because, like, for example, I have two dogs at my house, and one of them doesn't necessarily sit like a normal dog. She actually, you know, puts her legs out, you know, kicks her legs out like an actual human would do, especially when she's on the couch. And they were also, I guess they got to the point where they can kind of tell time, because, like, at 5 o'clock a.m. in the morning, they come barging in my room and jump in my bed and wake me up. And I guess that's from seeing my father, you know, do that pretty much almost every day. So do you think it's possible that they can pick up human characteristics?
Well, like I said, I mean, they're very, very smart. And it's funny that you say about your dog sitting like that, because I have a dog that sits like that. And, you know, we used to take care of what doggy daycare or whatever you want to call it. And they used to call her on her butt Betty, because she would just sit, you know, on her behind. And then with her legs, she just looked like a regular person. But they learn routines. So my dogs are the same. I mean, literally at 5 in the morning, they're sleeping. You move. Like, all right, time to eat. Same thing in the afternoons. They know when it's time to eat. I mean, they know. It's almost like you said, it's almost like they know time. They know when that time is. How do they do it? I mean, I don't know, but they know what time it is. And, I mean, it's a lot of time. It's just routine because you're doing the same things over and over and over. I mean, you know, my dogs get fed at the same time in the morning, and they get fed at the same time in the afternoon. So, but yeah, I mean, certain things are going to see you, and they're going to know your behaviors, and they may just relate to that.
I've heard that, going with the human thing, some people say that animals can't necessarily, they don't necessarily have, like, emotions. And I don't quite understand that, because every time my dog does something wrong, like, you know it, because her head is down and she'll, like, try to sneak through the house.
Yeah, I mean, they do have emotions. And, I mean, there's a lot of things out there that obviously we're still learning. And there's a lot of things that we are about to learn from all these other species, because the thing is, you know, they can't talk to us. So we're still learning a lot through medicine, just like human medicine. And, you know, every day there's new advances in human medicine. It's the same thing in, you know, in veterinary medicine or animal medicine. We're still learning new things about our pets. I think they do have emotions, just like you said. I mean, you know, so, you know, their dogs, when you walk into the house, they're extremely happy. They're wagging their tail. So, I mean, I think that's certainly emotion.
So I know it wasn't losing my mind. I talk to my dog every day. I be like, you want to go outside? He be like,
yeah.
Like, okay, I guess he wants to go outside. You want to eat? Yeah, I guess he wants to go. I just want to eat. Mm-hmm. I hop in the bed, he hop in the bed. I guess he knows what time it is.
For those who are looking for a puppy, let's say they're going to get a new dog or get a puppy, what should they look for? What are the signs of a healthy puppy?
That's a good question. I mean, you want to make sure that, you know, you make sure that there's no discharge, you know, from their nose. If there is, that it's just clear that there's no, you know, yellow or green stuff coming out of their nose or their eyes. Make sure that their ears are clean, that they're clean. And if they can watch for any type of external parasites, for example, fleas and ticks, some of these things, you know, we can see them. And a lot of times, you know, it's good to, you know, maybe just go visit the pet more than once and see how their interaction are, you know, how they interact with you and how things change as time goes by. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you can go to a shelter and, you know, you can see a pet and you like it. And, you know, they may let you, you know, take them for a walk. You can interact with the pet. A lot of times they'll let you, if you have pets already, you can bring them in so they can interact and see if they're going to get along. So there's a lot to it. There's a lot of, you know, tools online that can, you know, depending on your lifestyle, it's always good to say, you know, not just pick a breed because the dog looks pretty or because your friend has one of these dogs. We want to research these breeds because every breed is different and their requirements are going to be different. And not every dog fits everybody's lifestyle. So we want to certainly research those breeds and see if it's something that's going to suit our lifestyle. For example, I mean, if we live in an apartment or we live in a house or if we have kids, any of those things certainly should come into consideration when we're looking at a pet.
What are some of the things that the common person should look for if there may be something wrong with their dog or cat or pet?
So their personal pets, for example? Mm-hmm. Well, anytime, any – so you know – your pet better than anybody else, just like a parent will know their kids better than anybody else. You have that intuition. I mean, you have a 2-year-old, and we know when he doesn't feel good because he's not acting the way he usually does, even though he's 2. So, you know, those terrible 2s. Sometimes they have their own mind and they want to do their own things, but you still know when they're not acting right. I mean, if we're not eating, or if we're not coming to you, if we're hiding, if there's any vomiting, diarrhea, anything that looks abnormal from their regular routine should be something that we might want to consider, you know, bringing our pets in to the veterinarian and having them looked at.
Are there any, like, special facilities where they take dogs when they have to train them in certain ways, like how to walk the blind or like attack dogs and whatnot?
Yeah, there's different organizations for all that. You know, certainly, for example, police dogs. I mean, the police departments, they're going to have their own trainers. And, I mean, these are very rigorous, you know, selection processes. Not every dog is going to be able to be a police dog. Not every dog is going to be able to be, you know, to help somebody that's disabled, or not every dog is going to be a therapy dog. So, you know, it's very selective when they go through these things. But depending on what they want to do, they're going to go through special training. And there's different facilities for all those things. So, for example, police departments are going to, you know, have their dogs trained by somebody specific or somebody within the department. The dogs for therapy, you know, they may go somewhere else. So there's different entities that take care of all those different trainings.
I recently got a bunny from a friend, but she was living in a cat carrier. She was drinking water out of a bowl and she wasn't litter box trained. So I got her all the stuff she needed, but she's not adjusting very well. How can I help her to adjust?
Good question. And sometimes it takes some, you know, it's going to take some time. It's just repetitive. Animals are, you know, It's just they need a routine. So it's just getting used to it. It's just like kids. I mean, they don't learn how to use the bathroom immediately. So it's just repetitive, you know, just slowly work with it. Just show her where her litter box is. If she goes out of the litter box and you see her, just immediately put her back in there so she understands that that's what you want her to do.
All right. Well, we're at the very end. A very special thank you to Dr. Carlos Varela, Buck Lake Animal Hospital. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. This edition of 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Team Podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.